Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host, Felicity Sidnell Reed, and our guest this week, Eric E. Wright, novelist and non-fiction writer. Okay, so Eric, I'm going to ask you a little about your series, the most recent of which is Rust Bucket. So tell us about the first books in that series.
Yeah, Rust Bucket is the third in a series featuring this writer who previously was employed by one of the Toronto papers, Josh Radley, but it didn't go well the first time he sort of stepped out of the harness and got involved with trying to discover who were the terrorists who were targeting American interests from Canadian soil. Out of that came the Lightning File, but his boss fired him because of failing to do what he had been ordered to do and sort of going off on his own tangent. He's sort of an independent guy anyway. Secondly, since he grew up in Pakistan as a missionary kid, he thought, well, you know, I'd like to go back there. But when he got an assignment from an archaeological journal to write about the Indus civilization, they were doing some digging there. He thought, here's the ideal opportunity. So he went back to Pakistan to write about discoveries about the Indus civilization. During that time, he got all involved with smugglers, involved in human smuggling and smuggling antiquities and other things. And that became the book, The Captives of Manada. Manada is the name of the place that they were excavating.
Okay.
And then thirdly, Rust Bucket, the third in the series, and he's going to Vancouver Island to try and write, before anyone else gets there, write a feature on the discovery of a ship that is beached in a storm and is full of immigrants who are immigrants or really those who have brought as captives. Hmm. So that's what Rust Bucket is about, this old ship beached on the shore of Vancouver Island.
And a suggestion of human trafficking by the sounds of things.
Yeah, it's human trafficking, yep.
Hmm. Now, from time to time, issues of faith come up in your novels. Does this mean that you gear them for the Christian market?
Not really. They're written in a sort of a non-dogmatic, non-preachy style where the story sort of overtakes the faith issues in a way. So the story and the characters carry the book.
So if I was not Christian, would I be turned off by the allusions to faith in the books? Or are they a low enough profile that you can just keep reading?
Yeah, amazingly enough, non-Christians seem to love them, even those who don't have any faith whatever, because my focus is upon the characters and the story and trying to develop a very fast-paced way of telling it so that it's interesting. I don't really focus on the Christian elements, although it's there. There are Christians dealing with marriage, problems, and that's real life.
Yeah.
So they see real life.
Well, like in the bit you read in the first section, they just happened to be at a church service, but it didn't really play a part in the story. They could have been,
been
at a theater or somewhere. It really didn't matter.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, is writing for you mainly a solitary occupation, or do you connect with other writers when you're working on a book?
Well, certainly the hard work is is done in your office, is done as a solitary occupation, but I find it absolutely crucial to have input. So whenever I'm doing a book, I join a critique group, either a local critique group like the Spirit of the Hills has, or an online critique group, and chapter by chapter, I sort of present the book to them. Felicity has been in one of them, and we've worked together on her book and my book. And so, I find it absolutely crucial to have other input. Of course, Mary Helen is the first and best critiquer.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I love my critique group. They have saved my sanity many an occasion.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps you would read to us a bit from Rust Bucket.
Okay. Rust Bucket. Over the protests of his wife, let me give you a little background here. Josh Radley, who has been diagnosed with prostate cancer and has an appointment for prostate cancer coming up. Over the protests of his wife, he flies from Toronto to Victoria because he wants to get this story so he can beat other reporters to the story. So with great difficulty, he arrives on a remote beach on the Pacific coast of Vancouver and Island. I take up the story. Hidden by a screen of cedar boughs, I peered at the beached freighter through the telephoto lens of my camera. It was a small freighter with only two cranes to handle freight. The deck was clear of containers. Streaks of rust obscured the original white paint and its name. The pounding waves had pushed its stern toward the beach and canted it to one side. Offshore, what looked like a Navy patrol vessel bobbed in the heavy surf. Two rubber inflatable Zodiacs were pulled up onto the shore, one on either side of the ship, and a large tent surrounded by concertina wire had been erected well above the reach of the waves, probably to hold detainees. Except for two men dressed in tactical gear, no one stirred. Both faced the ocean and the freighter. I took a series of pictures, then headed toward the ship. When I was about 100 feet away, the officer spun around and lifted his submachine gun and shouted at me, "Hey, you, stop! Don't come any farther. This is a restricted zone." Restricted? I didn't see any signs. I'd encountered military and police personnel too often in my career as a journalist to be intimidated by their bravado. He swore, "We don't need signs, buddy. Leave now. Return to wherever you came from." I fumbled in my pocket, retrieved my press card, and holding it up, approached him. "Here, have a look." His scowl changed to a look of puzzlement. As he was looking at it, I pointed out that I'm really surprised there aren't more reporters here already. "Soon there'll be news choppers circling above. Whatever's going on here, you can't throw a press blackout over it. The public has an enormous interest in events like this. Remember the foul-ups over the Tamil smuggling case?" He reached out, took my press card and squinted at it, then hollered at another guard, "Hey, Frank, keep an eye on this bozo while I check this out." Just then the tent flap opened and three figures appeared. One looked like someone in customs or the RCMP. Another was in army fatigues. But the third was a woman with black hair. Nadia, my contact in CSIS. The three figures strode toward me. "Radley, what are you doing here?" Nadia shouted. I hadn't expected Nadia at the site, at least not so quickly. So she was keeping up the illusion that she hadn't given me the lead. "Just doing my job," I shouted back. Nadia beckoned me over. "Major Fletcher, Sergeant Neal, this is Josh Radley, one of those burrs that CISA seems to pick up whenever we try to mount an operation." I held out my hand, but neither made any move to shake it. "A burr? That's not very flattering." Nadia winked. "Don't take it personally, Mr. Radley. It's just that you have such an uncanny way of insinuating yourself into sensitive operations. To change the metaphor, you seem to pop up in one dark spot after another, just like a magic mushroom." I could understand why Nadia wanted to pretend innocence. I grinned. "You've just described one of the qualities of a good journalist." "Let's get in out of the rain," Sergeant Neal said, pointing toward the tent. "It's irregular, but with Major Khan vouching for him, I think we can take a chance." The smell of unwashed bodies mingled with the stink of terror assailed my nostrils as I entered the enclosure. On each side stood a soldier in full body armor wielding an automatic weapon. In the middle huddled a couple of hundred refugees. Except for a cluster of a dozen or so who looked healthy and wore Western dress, most appeared gaunt, almost to the point of emaciation. 20 or 30 young women dressed in shalwar, baggy cotton pants, and chemise, long shirts, cowered at the far side of the tent. Some stared at the ground. The eyes of others flitted here and there. Still others kept wrapping and rewrapping their headscarves, their dupattas. My stomach gave a lurch as I stood and gazed around. In spite of my attempt to maintain the image of a hard-boiled journalist, moisture began to collect at the corner of my eyes, and with it, rage. This was horrific. And so the story continues, but is quickly interrupted by smugglers. The original smugglers are returning with overwhelming force to reclaim their property. And so Josh is plunged into the murky world of human trafficking in Seattle and Vancouver.
Well, thank you very much, Eric.
Welcome.
Where can listeners buy your books?
They can buy them at all the local bookstores, Kerr's in Campbellford, The Lighthouse in Brighton, Searchlight and Let's Talk Books in Coburg, and Furby's in Port Hope. They're also available in local libraries, online, as well as in hard copy through Amazon. And, of course, the best way to get it is directly through my website, www.countrywindow.ca.
Okay. And listeners, if you'd like to connect with us here at the program, please send your comments, queries, or suggestions to our website, wordonthehills.com. At the website, you'll also find all our programs archived so that you can listen to them again. Thanks for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us for another program next Sunday at 1 o'clock on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.